So, Graham, we got a very special episode of 2 out of 3 Falls podcast. And obviously, we are on the road to WrestleMania 40. And, you know, some very important individuals might come up during this time. So today we got Mr. John Finkel. He's the author of the upcoming book on Macho Man Randy Savage entitled Macho Man, The Untamed, Unbelievable Life of Randy Savage. You can follow him on social media, on Twitter, X, at John, J-O-N underscore Finkel. You can find Graham Matthews also on X and Twitter, at WrestleRant. Find myself, Randy J. Cruz, R-E-N-D-Y, letter J, C-R-U-Z. So, John, right out the gate, man, listen, Macho Man is one of the greatest characters, the performers ever in pro wrestling. But before we get to him, I just want to ask you, as we always do for a guest, like, what made you become a fan of pro wrestling in totality?
So I grew up, as we were just talking, in the early 80s, and it was at the time when, like, the wrestlers were larger than life in terms of size-wise, my age. You know, I was 6, 7, 8, started watching all the main events, the pay-per-views, especially back then, the Saturday Night main events. And I was at that age where, like, when you see someone like Hulk Hogan or Randy Savage, or for me, so I'm John. When I grew up, my guy was Macho Man, and actually my number two was Big John Studd. And I actually, as a kid, used to call myself Little John Studd. Mm. And I used to walk around, I used to make my own shorts with the stars on the side. Yeah. It was just captivating to me. And then a moment that really kind of kicked off where I went from, like, liking this to being all in was my dad, at a store signing for the place he worked, had Big John Studd come in to do, you know, like, still grand opening for the store to sign. And I got to have lunch with him, and, you know, like, you know, his hand swallowed up my arm, and just, like, seeing that, like, I went from wrestling is cool to, like, this is the greatest thing of all time. I want to just be around these guys and watch these guys. And so from that point on, like, I've been a fan ever since.
And I think it's cool that we all had different origin stories depending on our age. I know I'll let Graham tell his, but for me, you know, I really got into it. I think it was at WrestleMania 6, seeing Hogan Warrior. I seen a little bit of 1989 stuff, SummerSlam 89, but I think the hook was watching two good guys in the main event. Big Warrior fan. I love Macho. I'm more a fan of Macho and Warrior than I am of Hogan. Mm-hmm. But I think WrestleMania 6 was just the thing for me of, like, all right, this is it going forward. I bought all the toys, the wrestling buddies,
everything,
pay-per-views, all that kind of stuff. So that was my origin. I think Graham is going to be a little later on in the 2000s, right?
Yeah, he's a young guy. What, do you like the LA Knight now? You came in right now?
The funny thing is, so I'm like, as we get into the Macho Man stuff, I'm on the other end of the spectrum as far as I started watching in 2008. So, like, we're talking in a period where there's, like, almost no stars. Attitude Era well over by that point. I mean, they still have Cena, Orton, and Triple H and people like that on top, and that's who I became a fan of, those kind of guys. It was actually, I mean, again, it's not about me, so I'll just keep this brief, but William Regal was actually the one that kind of got me into wrestling, because that was when he was kind of on top around at that point doing his sort of thing. And it was the, you know, the grandeur and the pomp and circumstance, no pun intended, that kind of got me into WWE and pro wrestling and stuff like that. So, I mean, yeah, it's cool to hear how other people kind of got into it, because we all kind of are bonded by the same thing, regardless of when we got into it, you know?
You know what else is true is the wrestling itself. I think it gets lost a little bit, but I have a younger brother. And once you see it on screen, like, the amount of times we body slammed each other and headlocked each other and clotheslined each other just on our bed or on the couch, like, you just do the moves. It's like when you're watching football, you just go outside and play football. Yeah. Wrestling is like that. Sometimes it gets lost in, like, which character or which, you know, guy was the best promo. But, like, I love the wrestling. I mean, I practiced, like, suplexes, like, in the backyard on my little brother endlessly. Yeah. You know, it was awesome.
Of course. So I'll start off by asking this. So what was the origin of you writing this book? And obviously there has to be a lot of Macho Man influence, the character, maybe the real life Randy Poffo. Like, what was it that drew you to Randy Macho Man Savage and ultimately led you to say, you know what, let me get a pen and paper and start writing about a book about this this guy?
Yeah, Macho was always my guy. Like, we all have our guys. Like, once I got to be probably 7, 8, 9, especially in that era, it was like, he's coming up, his promos, especially early on with the twitching and the moving and the spinning around and the colors, like, he's obviously he's definitely the most eye-catching guy maybe ever, really. And so at that age, just, you wanted to, you know, you're very impressionable, and just the sunglasses and the swagger that he had. And so I was all in on Macho from the very beginning. I had the Wrestle Buddy dolls and the lunchbox and the Saturday morning cartoons, and I was just very invested in it. And I've talked about it a few times when I've been interviewed for the book. And it's like, I was at the age where I believed everything, right? So like, it's not only like, yeah, I'm kind of retroactively saying like, oh, he was, you know, the high flying off the ropes and the elbow drops and all those things. But realistically, like, I believed that, like, he, you know, smashed Tito Santana's, like that he went after Tito Santana and like in the Boston Garden and won it. And that like, he crushed, you know, like he crushed everybody that he went through. And like Ricky Steamboat, who I liked, but he all of a sudden turned bad and like broke his larynx heading into WrestleMania. And like that really happened. And I didn't know that he and Liz were together. And I thought they really got married. And like the big one that you'll appreciate as a Warrior fan is like, I remember like the retirement match as a retirement match because I was like nine. Like,
yeah.
I remember sitting there with my friends having everybody over eating pizza. Like, so one of these guys is never wrestling ever again. Like, what? Like when you realize that when you're in at that age and no one kind of ruins it for you, the stakes are real, right? So I was rooting for Macho as if he may never wrestle again. I was rooting for him as a guy who like really, got, you know, I know he really got bit by a snake, but like that whole thing was like, oh my God, like he could die. I don't know what's going to happen to him. And there was no social media in between. So like, you know, the show would end and now it's like instantly you're on Twitter. What's going on? What's happening? I can find this. I can listen to you guys. But then it was like, okay, I guess next Saturday I'll know something.
You know, true, yeah.
It was really that those cliffhangers killed you. So for me, Macho was by far the most compelling guy. And I'd written, this is my 10th book to your first part of your question. I'd always wanted to tackle this book. And I just knew it would be a massive undertaking, his legacy. The thesis for the book for me was like how you go from, you know, Randy Poffo, the wrestler's son slash like all he wanted to do is play baseball, to Randy Savage, the ICW guy, to like the icon Macho Man. That was kind of my pitch for the book. And I knew what it would take. And by the time I got to my career deep enough where I felt confident and comfortable I could tackle it, luckily no one had done it yet. Mm-hmm. And I was like, now's the time. And so that was like the start of it. And then, you know, there's a proposal and you pitch it and it gets sold and all that. But from the minute I pitched it to selling it to everything was like a 4-year process.
So, Graham, before you go, I think John makes a valid point where it's funny how in today's wrestling, it just, you know, we want everything to be right away with no patience. We're really like in tune and smart about things, right? So when you mentioned that when you thought Macho Man was retiring because of Warrior at WrestleMania 7, we said, oh, like as a kid, oh, shit, Macho Man's done. He's going to retire. And then like you see him wrestle near November with Jake. Yeah. None of us are saying, oh, come on, that's not part of why. Why would you do a storyline at WrestleMania 7, a retirement? Why is he coming back? If that happened today, we're all complaining about it. Like, oh, come on, that don't make sense. Why do a retirement match if you're going to come back 5 months later?
Yeah, that was a really interesting thing that I, so my son is 11 and is all, you know, he's just, he could not be more into like this era now. We're going to WrestleMania. We're going to do all the stuff, especially with the push. It's going to be awesome. But he got to relive all of this stuff in order. So I got to like condense like the peak of Macho Man watching as my childhood into like 4 months for him. So, you know, you can stream all the WrestleManias. You can go on YouTube and see almost his debut, you know, Piper's Pit. You can see everything. So he watched all of that while simultaneously like all the storylines of the last couple of years. And so he's a super now, like he now knows that, you know, that it's kind of, you know, it's planned and all that. So he's just a super intelligent fan and you know, has the questions that we would have as an adult of like, why would they do that? Like this makes no sense. Or like, what's the storyline here? But to see him originally like understand, like, I'm like, you got to see this stuff. This was 3 years of my, like, you got to see it all in a couple months and we'd watch, you know, 3 WrestleManias in a row. And then all the, you know, we could go all his matches with Hogan in an hour, right?
Yeah.
Or less really. So yeah, that is, it's kind of lost on all the 24/7 reporting and the dirt sheets and everything. There are a big faction of kids who like just watch it because it's compelling and it's cool and they don't know what's going to happen and they don't care. True. There's no decision in their mind. Like, this guy lost and hopefully he wins next time.
Exactly. RG, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I guess going off of that, it's such a great point as far as I feel like that magic is kind of lost today because I'm an example of that too. I mean, we're going back 16 years here for when I first started watching, but when I first started watching at, I don't know, 13 years old, whatever it was, it was a little bit later on. I knew at that point it was fixed, scripted, whatever. I never grew up in a point where I thought it was real. So that's, I don't know what the percentage would be nowadays as far as like how many kids think it's real and how many people fall off after finding out that it's not. like a Christmas Santa Claus type thing. Kind of tying that back to Macho Man, do you think, John, there's a good chance as far as that's why Macho Man was so successful back in the day, at least part of it, was that when people thought it was real, he was an over-the-top character, just amazing. But as you get older, as you can obviously probably attest to, you start to appreciate the fact he's just literally one of the greatest of all time, even just as a worker. You're starting to appreciate that aspect more as you get older. Is that kind of a loss today with today's generation, not just of fans, but of wrestlers, as far as, you know, when you kind of lose that magic of it's not really real anymore, they're not latching onto the current characters of today to continue watching, and how Macho Man was just such a big part of that back in the day?
Yeah, Macho was probably the best storyteller that we've, I think the best storyteller we've ever had, because A, he lived the character full time. I mean, there was no break, which everybody famously knows, but it's true. Everybody, I interviewed all the wrestlers back then, all the people backstage. There was Macho Man, and then there was Macho. There was like, there wasn't someone else's hand on the steering wheel. There was like Macho Man and Macho Man, just a crazier version of each other. Randy Poffo was long gone, and even Randy Savage in a lot of ways was long gone. And so, yeah, I think we definitely lose the area where we lose it in, and even right now with like The Rock's whole thing, the Hollywood heel turn everybody loves. But like, if you're on Instagram, like a minute later, he's doing something great for kids, or like, here's my new armpit deodorant, whatever he has going on, right? And, you know, my son's not, I don't let him on any of that social stuff at this point. So, but I think, you know, in the next couple of years, he probably would be. And so it's very hard to have these guys come out and be evil and villainous and all those things and get booed. And then on Instagram, they're like, here's my morning routine. I just had oatmeal and I'm on the elliptical or whatever.
Yeah.
It breaks it. Whereas the big difference is like back then, one of the reasons Randy and the ICW and, you know, struggled really early on financially is because he was such a heel. There were no extra opportunities to make money. So for instance, back then in the 70s, when he and Jerry Lawler had their territorial, you know, fighting and rivalry, Lawler could go sell t-shirts. He was a good guy. He could sign. He could go do grand openings for things. He could go open up a restaurant. Like, he could open up a car wash or show up. He could make money. But since the reality there back then, for especially like the real old school guys, was if people boo me in, I want them to boo me walking down the street. I want them to think I am that guy.
Yeah.
He couldn't do anything. He had to go like, he made money like selling vitamins through the phone. Like, he had no other way to make money, A, because of how he looked and what he did, but he couldn't supplement his income as like a good guy. Hey, I'll show up at your birthday party for $500. Like, nobody wanted him. He was on purpose a heel, and he lived it. So it really wasn't until the WWE days early on where the heel was able to pay for everything for his lifestyle.
Mm-hmm. I would ask this. I would ask the fact that whenever you write a book, in your mind, there's X amount of people that you feel like, I got to get these on video, on camera, on, you know, get a quotes. So for Macho Man and a long career he's had, who did you feel like it's a must to get somebody to talk about him for this book? And who are the key people, if you want to say it, the key people that declined to talk about Macho Man?
Yeah, well, the number one person was his brother, Lanny Poffo. So from a time frame, everybody knows he passed away last year. Mm-hmm. I originally put the proposal for this book together in 2020, right as I was finishing my previous book, 1996. And I had a couple of publishers interested, but I'm like I said, I'm close to my brother. I just couldn't imagine anybody even trying to find something out about me in a public sense without talking to him. And I just couldn't imagine doing this book without talking to Lanny. It just wouldn't have felt right, mainly because of this exact moment. I didn't obviously know he was going to pass away, and it's horrible, but I couldn't imagine going through all this work and effort and then sitting down to an interview about the book and someone saying, did you talk to Lanny? And being like, actually, no. Then I would, even me as a listener, be like, well, what the hell, dude? Like,
what's the point? The guy. Yeah.
So it took me over a year to get in touch with Lanny. He lived in Ecuador. He didn't use any traditional, he had no phone. Like, I had to end up, a friend of mine who I interviewed for 1996, JP Zarka, who runs the pro wrestling site, I have to give him a nod because the book would not have happened without him. He knew Lanny. He'd done a couple podcasts with him in the early 2020s.
Yeah.
And he got me in touch. And it took a year of like a random Facebook message, a Telegram note, until we finally were able to talk. And so we finally get on the phone and he starts hitting me like right off the bat. He asked if I'm related to Howard Finkel, which I was like, I'm not, but my dad's Harvey Finkel, and they have the same initials. Maybe that counts for something. He laughed. He's a clever guy, and he appreciated that. And then he just hammered me with a bunch of questions about Randy, which I guess I passed or at least answered properly. It wasn't like deep trivia. It was just like, what do you think of this? And how do you feel about this happened? And did you watch this? And do you know about this thing?
Yeah.
And after that, we kept going, and he was like, all right, what do you want from me? And I said, well, here's why I want to do this book. Here's why I think I'm the guy. and I have, you know, 30 questions. Like, as long as you time you have, I would love to talk. And then as things come up, maybe just if you're available. And he was like, shoot. And then we talked for like 3 hours. Wow. Like he answered every possible tangent question about their life, their childhood, their dad, the big WrestleMania moments, you know, Jake's moments. And then like, even just like, just the main stuff that I think makes these book work. Like, what was their apartment like? What did it like when they lived? What did he really think backstage here? What, you know, what did he eat? How did he train? Like the stuff that nobody could figure out, and the stuff that, you know, the guys who are the superstars that they pull in the documentaries don't really even know or talk about. So Lanny was by far the number one. And then unfortunately he passed away. I was about halfway done writing. So all my research was done. I'd been pinging him every now and then with like, you know, hey, when you guys were in Toledo, like, what was that thing like? Whatever, that kind of small stuff. Mm-hmm. And then JP texted me that he passed away. And I had a sheet next to me, literally on the desk where I'm sitting now. It was called Lanny Cues, that I just kept a running tab of like, oh, don't forget next time you, and a lot of times touching base would honestly be like a random Telegram thing at midnight that he would write me back or something. And he passed away. So I dedicated the book to him, and he's the clear number one. And it was in my head, like, if I don't somehow talk to him and have him on board with just as a resource, then I wouldn't do it. So he's the critical guy.
And who is the one or two guys that are not in it that you felt should be in it?
Well, the good news, if there's a silver lining to doing a book like this with someone who's passed away, is he passed away at a time when everybody was already online and doing things. So when he passed away in 2011, everyone from Hogan, everyone he'd ever, you know, Bret Hart, they'd all had and said their piece all over the place. So one of the first things I did with research was go through and find every interview everybody did in the 3 to 4 months after he passed away. Some of them did full podcasts on everything and every story. And what I did was I kind of synced up the stories that they told over and over as like, these were sort of the more the relevant ones. And then I went from there. So, you know, like Hogan, between the documentaries and all that stuff, I didn't think he was critical at all to talk to. I know it sounds silly, but like I have 7 hours of him talking about Macho on tape. Like there was nothing new he was going to say. He famously basically only gets paid to talk anyway from what I've heard. And I reached out several times. I went up to Hogan's hangout and tried to set everything up, and it wasn't going to happen. So, everybody has their own thing. So it wasn't that big of a deal to me. It was more of the guys who hadn't really talked. So one of the guys I was pumped to talk to and did get to talk to extensively was Hacksaw Jim Duggan. Oh, like he's not like in the documentaries really. Like for some reason, the WWE has their go-to people, you know, that they always, you know, Bret Hart, they can go to Hogan, and they go to their stable, and they're all in the same five people. Even Hogan's wife are in all the documentaries that they've done. But I like Paul Roma, like the early 80s guys who like knew him before he grew up. So I talked to him and Ricky Steamboat and all these kind of guys who you get into, you know, Rip Rogers from, you know, really, really early on. Those are the guys to me that I thought could really flesh out who he was, because everybody's heard the interviews from those five or six superstars over and over again. And that to me, you know, Hacksaw's interview was gold. And then probably one of the best interviews in the book is I interviewed Mr. Wonderful Paul Orndorff's son, who used to travel with his dad with these guys. Like imagine, dude, like Randy, being our age, 8, 9 years old, your dad's Mr. Wonderful Paul Orndorff, you know, kissing his armpit, you know, kissing his bicep, doing that stuff.
Exactly.
And then you're on the bus afterwards with all your heroes going town to town, flying places. And he got to see a side of Macho Man and the side of these guys that literally no one else did. I never heard an interview with anyone from that age. And so he ended up being, you know, just through a, you know, pulling the thread of conversations, one of my favorite people to talk to.
G?
When you go to a project like this, you mentioned just being a diehard wrestling fan, Macho Man fan, and already having written so many books before this. At the beginning of this timeline of getting into the Macho Man project, do you overestimate the amount of research that you have to do for Macho Man specifically? Or, I mean, just being such a diehard fan, it doesn't really feel like you're doing as much research as you are. And it just kind of comes a lot easier to you because you already know a lot about him.
Yeah, no, I think it goes not against you or for you, but it's more of more work because you have a familiarity. Mm-hmm. You want to make sure you're not writing a book that you would just read the whole time, be like, know that, I know that, yeah. I know that, I know that. Like that's the worst version of this book, right? So it's actually like I kind of was punishing myself, like, all right, you got to go in. I talked to his entire high school baseball team. I talked to his wrestling coach in high school. I talked to his neighbors in Downers Grove where he grew up. I talked to guys who only wrestled with his dad who are 90 years old. Wow. Like, I went into his Facebook group and found his minor league baseball teammates. Like, I found extras on Spider-Man. I found people who were at grand openings for him in the 90s that like were kids. Like, so I really went deep. And when you talk about like what you know and research, the only rule that holds is the same rule that like Mike Tyson always says for a fight, right? Like I can have my proposal, I can have all the points that I want to hit, but like Tyson says, like you can have your fight plan and it all works until you get punched in the mouth, right?
Exactly.
And so the same thing happens with the book. I have everything down until I talk to the first person. And the first person I'll talk to always will invariably say, if you're a good researcher, the last question is always, is there anyone else I should talk to? Who do I have to talk to get this right? That like, if you're not asking that as a journalist, and you really have to figure out what you're doing in this business. And invariably, it's they list one or two people who you've never heard of, and you're like, oh, okay. And then you're off. Then you're like, okay, now we're going. And yeah, I'll check the box and make sure I talk to all the people who I heard of. But it is always the people who you haven't heard of who by far tell you the best stories.
Mm. So I know you got to run soon, but I got a few more questions for you. Obviously, you're a big Macho Man fan. So if I had to put you on the fire and ask you your Mount Rushmore of Macho Man matches.
Yeah.
There's a lot of them, a lot of rivalries, a lot of good guy, bad guy stuff. What matches are you picking for Macho Man?
Yeah, we'll put aside the WrestleMania 3. That I mean, it's hard to that's like a layup. One of the greatest matches of all time, right?
Yeah.
One of the matches that I think is really phenomenal with his, and he loses, but with him and Warrior, right? So what the beauty of Macho Man is that he's not a big dude, and he didn't grow up a big guy, right? So most of the wrestlers we hear about, read about, Hogan, Warrior, Hacksaw, even Million Dollar Man, like of that era, obviously Andre the Giant. They were big men their whole lives. They were the kids in high school who you're like, obviously he's a heavyweight wrestler. Obviously he's an offensive lineman or defensive lineman. Like they were all big men and had been looked up to as big men their whole lives. Randy was a 6'1", 180-pound, 185-pound baseball player into his early 20s. He was not a physical specimen. He was not somebody that stood out on the street. Nobody would look up to him as far as like, whoa, that guy's an impressive, like, big dude. Like, he's obviously a wrestler. Like, you would never peg him for a wrestler. Even one of the first times Dusty Rhodes saw him was right when he left baseball to wrestle. And his first comment was, like, he is, talented, but, like, way too small to wrestle. So he spent the first 3 years after baseball essentially just, devouring protein, steak, eggs, like everything the Lou Ferrigno 1970s Arnold Schwarzenegger diet has to offer to get huge. So he went up to 200 pretty quick. 210, and Lanny talks about how difficult it was for his frame because he was actually doing some bodybuilding at the time, which most people don't know. He actually stood on a stage with Lou Ferrigno, like at a posing contest.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
In Kentucky. There's this image is really old of like Randy Savage, Rip Rogers, and Lou Ferrigno on like a posing stage in like their little bikinis for like a Mr. Kentucky 1975 or something. Mm-hmm. So he was trying to do all that. And so all this ties to Ultimate Warrior because with Savage famously like walked on his tippy toes, big shoulders, moved all around to take up space. It never really seemed that he was that much smaller than Hulk, even though he gave up like 6 or 7 inches. Even the mega handshake, the famous thing people see, like he's smaller, but you don't think like, oh, they're like noticeably different.
Yeah.
The Warrior match, even though he loses, he is so small. He looks like a kid. If you watch when Warrior picks him up and gorilla press and drops him, it looks like I might do it to my son or you would do it to your little brother. When they stand toe-to-toe at one point, I think it's like 7 or 8 minutes, because Macho comes out hot and then they do the whole thing and Warrior's questioning the gods of like how he could not working. Like, how is this guy not going? He's giving him all these things. The thing that stands out now and that's so impressive is that match was totally – was awesome and sold perfectly even leading up to it. Macho's on Arsenio. Like, you're watching this match. And somewhere now that I've done all the research, I'm realizing how hard that must have been to sell for Randy to compete, to look like he belonged in a ring with a guy who had several inches and probably 70 pounds of muscle on him. And so to me, he was a little deeper in his career, obviously, at that point in time. Mm-hmm. And we still have the Ric Flair match coming up and all the other stuff. But that came at a point where, like, if he's not able to go toe-to-toe with a guy so much bigger and equally as athletic, that was the thing. I think the reason he and Hogan, those matches, when they were even on, wrestling and mega powers, like he's smaller, but he's like 50 times the athlete of Hogan. He's faster, quicker, stronger, can leap. Hogan was not an incredible athlete. Warrior like ran a 4.240 to get to the ring. Like he could kind of out macho in the athletic department. And so to me, that's the most impressive match.
So Macho Warrior is like your, aside from WrestleMania 3, that's your holy grail.
That's my favorite, because I was, at that point, just like you, Warrior is my clear number two. I almost like wish they could have both won that. I just love that match. I've watched it probably 15 times while I was writing this book, just because there's moments where you freeze frame and like you lean forward and you're like, it looks like he's facing a giant. Like, how is he even selling this stuff?
And listen, I would have loved to be in the locker room or in Gorilla after WrestleMania 7, because in real life, I guess he wasn't expecting Warrior to step on him afterwards for the pin. I think I heard Macho was really tight about that. Like, I can't even imagine how mad he was. But like those little things, like, why would Warrior of all people just like step on Macho and Macho would allow that? Like, really? Like, I'm thinking it's planned. Like, Macho's down with that, but then you come to find out he's not really down with that. So that's a kind
of Macho was tidbit. Like, the beautiful thing about Macho was he was obsessive compulsive. He planned everything out. He wanted everything to go perfectly. But the thing that I think people misguided about is that he wanted everything to go perfectly for the fans. He obviously had his own ego and his own plan, but his number one responsibility always was, don't ruin this for the fans. I mean, if you look at that match, you look at the WrestleMania 3, he lost. We talk about WrestleMania 3 as if he won the match. He lost. Like, the whole thing, the whole genius of it, the planning of it, everything was not for him to be victorious. Like, he lost the biggest match of his life, and it actually kind of tilted him on like a wayward. He didn't know what, they didn't really know what to do after that. A, everybody kind of recognized that as maybe like the Mona Lisa of wrestling matches. Yeah. And B, it was like, well, now what? You know, like, and then Ricky left because he had kids and they couldn't really do the rematch or anything like that. But that's a really interesting thing to look at. And in that moment, I had the same thought and I've heard the same rumors, but you know, Macho's first thought was like, I can't ruin this for the fans of Warrior.
Yeah.
That was his first thought.
Gee, any final questions you got?
Yeah, similar question. I mean, we talk about the matches, and I love that match as well with Savage, even having gotten to wrestling so much later. I'm a big Warrior fan, Savage fan too, so that match is amazing. But we talk about matches. What about the promos? Was he as obsessive compulsive with the promos and just the magic of those as he was with the matches, and some of your favorite promos of Macho Man as well?
Yeah, absolutely. Listen, Macho, when Randy Savage was becoming Macho Man, and I do the book in like stages of how he becomes, you know, the character, Lanny said that, you know, what people don't understand is that the voice, he was kind of, they went to Hawaii for a year. His dad went to Hawaii for a year. They both kind of skipped the year of school. And they went to Hawaii because his dad got some wrestling gigs with the territory out there that we saw in Young Rock, if you watched it, but that was through that. And so they came back, and while they were there, the territory had a wrestler called Pampero Firpo who used to do these promos. I couldn't find him, and Randy actually did it for me. It's like, they'd be like, you're listening to the number one station. Oh yeah. Like, but it was this other guy.
Yeah.
And so they had these conversations of like, all right, Lanny had the gift of gab, was a great talker. He wasn't like a in your face promo guy, but he was clever, quick witted. He could move on his feet. He could move on the mic. And Randy was not, I mean, the funny thing about Randy, and when you read the book, is that through most of his life till that point, when you interview anyone in baseball, when you interview anyone from his high school, they don't have a whole lot to say about his personality because he didn't really have one. He was quiet. All of them to a man were like, you're asking me about a person who didn't exist. I didn't have a teammate Macho Man. I had a guy named Randy Poffo who was quiet and, you know, clean shaven and just wanted to play Major League Baseball and focused on Major League Baseball. There was no gimmick. Yeah. He was just a soft spoken. He was a leader because he was batting 550, you know, lefty and righty. But like, he was not a go-go guy. He wasn't that person. Even in the minors, he wasn't. And so from the promo side, the fact that like he basically, they went to what, you know, rappers, the lab or whatever they want to say, like he went into a bathroom. Lanny says that he would just stand in the bathroom and stare at himself and practice different guttural versions till he finally got to the stomach clenching and the whole thing. And then he just committed to it. Like, I'm never going to be seen not doing that. I'm never going to be seen not talking like that. And so for me, like when you ask the best promos, like I always say my son and I, it's great. Whenever like he gets in trouble, my little 11-year-old will be like, Dad, I'm unjustifiably in a position that I'd rather not be. And I'm like, well, if you clean your room, you wouldn't be in this position. You know, that's one of my favorites. And then he has a great one with Mean Gene where he's getting interviewed and he almost falls. And Mean Gene's like, oh, you're a little off balance, Randy. And he's like, off balance, I'm better. And I say, like, when we play hoops with my friend, my whole life, if I, like, you know, turn around and jump off somebody or I look like they fall, I will drop the on balance, off balance, I'm better than you are, always. So I know everybody loves cream of the crop and tallow power and cup of coffee and all those. But one of my favorite lines, and it really works for a lot of things, is on balance, off balance, I'm better than you are. But don't let your kids tell you when you ground them or you tell them, I'm taking your tablet away, you got to do your homework. If they hit you with the, oh, I'm unjustified, like you're justifiably in that position.
Exactly. My final two are very important. Is there any part in the book where you talk about Macho Man's brief rap hip hop career?
I do. I found the producer of the album. I found a lot of interviews. He did a lot of radio, incredibly, when that came out. Lanny actually wrote a song on that album, the Mr. Perfect dedication song. So we did talk about it. You know, the funny thing about that is he listened to rap working out, which is where it came from. Somebody saw him who produced in Tampa that he listened to it. And he, like everything else, he went 100% in, and like himself, he was able to always, he believed he was going to have like a, I don't know if he believed he had a full hit, like second career, but he believed he had a hit album. I think they sold, I looked a bunch of different sources. I think they sold 10,000 copies. So I don't know what below is, you know, gold, silver, platinum. Maybe it's copper, or you know, maybe nickel or something. But
I would say 10,000 is not very good.
No, probably not. And you know, those numbers, it's like, but how many did they buy to give away at the beginning? So I don't know how many people actually went out, bought it, and just bumped it in their car. And I'm not sure.
My last question, it's been great talking to you. You can find John Finkel on X at John_Finkel, JON. Just the overall legacy of Macho Man, what he means to the whole universe out there, the fandom, and like just your expectations of this book of Macho Man.
Yeah. The goal for this book for me was to let everybody who grew up when we did, Randy, like understand what he meant to a generation of us. What he meant to not only the diehard wrestling fans, but also, you know, a lot of the, you know, the 50% or 70% who fell off when they got to high school because of girls and sports and all that, you know, it just happens. You just get busy. But all of us who then come back into it, you know, when you have your own kids and now you're rewatching it again. And so I wanted it to be like a nostalgic ride for those of us who experienced it. And then, gee, like, you're younger than us, man. Like, you got to, when I put a lot of people in their spot. So when you're reading this book, and now I'm in a bad spot, like in the, what it was like to be us, right? So like I'm writing as a journalist, all the fun stuff, but I make great pains to understand, like, here's why you have to understand why this moment matters so much to us. We didn't know what we all know now. We had no idea that this was going to happen. Like the mega powers coming together was an experience that you can't reach today in any level. It doesn't matter. Even the Rock, Roman Reigns, it doesn't matter. Those were the two biggest names in wrestling. And you never thought they would come together. You never read rumors. There were no sheets. There was no newspaper columns about it. You were just sitting there as a kid watching one day. And then all of a sudden, Hogan runs out to rescue Randy Savage. Like, what the hell? And it's like your two heroes are now shaking hands and they're mega powers. Like, I put people in that spot. And then the flip side is, you know, when it went bad, you were just like, what's wrong with you, Randy? Or on the other side, like, Hulk, how could you betray him like this?
Exactly.
Like, I put you in that spot so that you understand why all of this meant so much to us. And that's my goal for the book, is that it gives everybody like a understanding of what he meant, gives us that kind of nostalgia hit that we wanted who grew up, and then the next generation and even my son's age, who's kind of slowly flipping through his copy, of like understanding the journey that someone like Macho Man takes to become a wrestler, especially in that era to what he was. And then his staying power is just, you know, Slim Jim with all the stuff. You've got LA Knight, a nice, you know, I think he's a nice like bridge guy. And a lot of these newer guys are starting to understand. I honestly feel like there's seeds of Macho in a lot of their promos nowadays.
Mm. Any final words, G?
No, I don't think so. I'm looking forward to reading the book. I think you do a great job of kind of offering a perspective on someone, for someone like me, like a newer fan who respects him and appreciates him for what it is. But I'm looking forward to learning more about Randy Poffo, the man, and his career prior to that point. So I appreciate you taking the time, John. This has been great.
Yeah, this is a lot of fun. Thank you, guys.
John Finkel, the author of Macho Man, The Untamed, Unbelievable Life of Randy Savage, is coming out soon, right?
April 2nd, WrestleMania week, and then I will I'll be at Mania signing a bunch of books, and we got a lot going on up there. I got a lot of giveaways. Anyone who buys the book, I have a hologram of the cover that I send everybody. It's pretty sweet. It's like a silver hologram, like of the cover, And then I have book plates that I've been signing, you know, oh yeah, mm-hmm. with your name on them and all that. So if anyone orders, go on Twitter, DM me the screenshot, and I'll send you some free cool stuff.
Nice, man. John Finkel, man. Thank you, man. Appreciate it. And enjoy WrestleMania 40.
I will. Thank you, guys.
All right. Take it easy.